Thanks so much, and thanks for inviting me, and thanks for braving the weather. And in fact, one of the projects is partly about Leeds, and I'm sure I've met some of you before at an event we had last year or the year before for the Queer Beyond London project, so it's good to see you here. So I wanted to start actually with pride, which is that emotion which is often wrapped around ideas of gay identity and community and has been for the last 40 years. And it's also the title of this rather wonderful 2014 film, which tries to capture a sense of that feeling of pride in the 1980s for an audience in the 2010s, a challenging task for filmmakers and also a challenging task for historians. As a result of the film, Mark Ashton gains some posthumous celebrity as the impassioned driving force between the lesbian and gay campaign to support striking miners in 1984 and 1985. Many of those miners and their families were moved to reciprocate that support, travelling to London from South Wales in July 1985 to lead off that year's Gay Pride with the Colliery Band. The scene depicted here with actor Ben Schnitzer playing Mark. The film and testimonial traces suggest that this was an emotional encounter between apparently very different groups of people who mobilised in each other's interests on the back of a solidarity articulated and experienced in terms of anger, compassion, empathy and indeed pride. So in this talk, I want to show why we need to take these emotions seriously in the past, and especially when we're trying to understand moments of crisis. So I want to suggest it's a way of understanding this moment of crisis in the 80s, but also ways in which it might help us understand our current moment of crisis. I do this by honing in on the AIDS epidemic in the UK and on a particular year, 1987, 2 years after the encounter of those pits and perverts, as the Sun newspaper had it at the time, and 6 years after the first known AIDS-related death in the UK. I'm going to say more about 1987 shortly, but for now it's enough to note that this was the year which saw a marked escalation in the number of those dying in the UK, and that amongst them was Mark Ashton, who died in February of that year at the age of 26. A few months later, in May, the Mass Observation Social Research Project asked its panel of 1,300 ordinary people for its views on the intensifying crisis. 633 people responded, with a total of well over 1,000 pages of largely handwritten testimony. You can tell, can't you, that I've spent quite... And some people's handwriting is a lot better than others, I can tell you. And it forms this testimony together, forms an incredible and incredibly moving archive, which gives us some shadowy sense of the emotional tumult surrounding AIDS in this particular year. One of just two gay men amongst the 633 testimonies was, I discovered, a friend of Mark Ashton's. And before I say more about 1987, before I say something about how I arrived at this work, and before I shape my argument more fully via this and other archives, I want to read you an extract from his testimony and then stay with it for a few minutes to map out some of the emotional terrain which I'm going to navigate in the rest of the talk. So these are the words of Mass Observer A1108. A mutual friend of Mark's waited until no one was around and then told me that Mark had been taken into hospital in the final stages of the disease. I went back to my office and telephoned my partner to tell him that Mark was very ill. When he asked me what was wrong with him, I did not say because I was afraid that the others in my office, hearing that I knew somebody with AIDS, would associate me with it. I went into the men's toilets and cried. On the day he died, the same mutual friend called me at work and asked me to meet her outside her office. She told me that she'd been with him the morning when he died. We stood in the corridor and both cried, and when one of her colleagues passed us to ask what was wrong, she said that Mark had been run over by a car and had died after being in a coma. Her colleagues were very sympathetic. Later, one of them heard her in the staff canteen telling her boyfriend what had really happened. When she came into work the next day, they'd moved her desk to the far side of the room and refused to speak to her. One man told her that he couldn't risk contact with her as he had children. She left her job shortly afterwards. So apart from expressing his fear of being overheard in the office when he called his boyfriend, this mass observer does not say directly how he felt about Mark's death and what happened to this mutual friend. He describes crying twice, but not what he felt. A complex knot of emotion might well have fueled those tears. Grief at the loss of Mark and other friends, a sense of isolation at not being able to share this news openly, fear, perhaps, for himself. As he wrote these words, he may also have been recalling feelings he experienced 2 weeks after Mark's death, when a passerby at Heathrow Airport called him a filthy AIDS queer, having seen him kiss his boyfriend goodbye on the cheek. Now, there's no certainty here about my emotional guesswork. Understanding our own emotional life can be hard enough. Trying to comprehend the emotions of people in the past feels like grasping at retreating shadows. The people in the testimony shared an apparently straightforward language of emotion, and one, of course, familiar to us too. But words like hate, fear, and love can mean and might relate to different things in different historical contexts. And at any historical moment, they described and evoked a range of thoughts and feelings. Different dimensions of fear, for example, were probably experienced by Mark as his illness developed, by his friends, including our mass observer, by their partners, and by the office mate keen to protect his children, for example. Emotions were experienced and expressed differently, depending on where these people were standing in relation to the crisis and those immediately affected by it. Unlike many of his fellow and largely heterosexual or normal mass observers, and I'm using their words, mass observer A1108 seems reticent in using emotions directly to describe what happened. There's a sense of restraint or containment in this man's simple descriptive prose. And I say that because having read the other testimonies, which are full, which are bursting with expressions of emotion. This one, which had, in a sense, the most direct contact, was one of the more subdued. And I think this containment, this sense of emotional containment, is significant and might relate, and this is more guesswork, to the necessity felt amongst many gay men and their allies at this time to hide from general view the grief, anxiety, anger, guilt, shame, and other emotions experienced in the context of serial loss and an anti-gay backlash which traded in blame and fear. Intense, exhausting grief and enduring anxiety were perhaps difficult to articulate amidst the loud proclamations that gay men were getting their just deserts. This dominant emotional pulse was sustained through the press, through pronouncements of self-appointed moral guardians, and through everyday jokes, anecdotes, and interactions. It gave tacit permission to the passerby at Heathrow to hurl his abuse at our mass observer, and for people in that office to shift quickly from sympathy to disdain for Mark's female friend when it became clear how Mark had really died. Mark's friend's deceit resonated for those others in the office with a wider belief that people were not being told the whole truth about HIV and AIDS. Even though the virus was identified in 1985 and a test rapidly developed, there was a continuing climate of uncertainty about transmission routes and degrees of risk. The icebergs and gravestones featured in the health campaign of 86 and 87 underscored this sense of looming threat and uncertain future. And let me just give you a reminder. Hopefully.
Ooh. There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all. It is a deadly disease and there is no known cure. The virus can be passed during sexual intercourse with an infected person. Anyone can get it, man or woman. So far it's been confined to small groups, but it's spreading. So protect yourself. I read this leaflet when it arrives. If you ignore AIDS, it could be the death of you. So don't die of ignorance.
so I'm sure a lot of us remember this. And what's absolutely fascinating looking at this recording is looking at what was being broadcast in the Netherlands at the same time, which had this rather happy little bee pollinating different flowers, and it was a much more, much gentler, much less, in a sense, emotionally laden piece of work. So what I'd suggest about this advert, this health warning, was that it was a particularly emotionally laden way of communicating that had by 1986 and 87 become the norm in depictions of the AIDS crisis. This was a sign of the fears evoked by the crisis, fears which related not only to the virus itself, but to broader anxieties about sex and sexuality, about the supposed collapse of traditional homes and families, about race and immigration, and about a feared apocalypse. There is perhaps a hint of nuclear winter in this public health broadcast, and that connection was made in the press and by several mass observers in this year, which historian of the AIDS crisis Virginia Berridge describes in terms of, I'm quoting, wartime emergency. So this is the Daily Mail. Shortly after the Chernobyl disaster, and AIDS was rendered an equivalent. It's probably becoming clear by now why I'm focusing on 1987, but let me say a little bit more about that choice and so fill in some further context. 1987 saw a doubling of the death toll from 300 to just over 600 people in the UK. Those with AIDS or HIV diagnoses moved into the thousands. Most of these people identified as gay men, the grouping I'm going to focus on here, and around 70% were living in London, lending a particular intensity to the crisis there. 1987 was the year when the first panel of the UK AIDS Memorial Quilt was sewn, and including a panel for Mark, you can see it there in the middle. It was also the year when construction began on the UK's first dedicated AIDS hospice, the Lighthouse in Ladbroke Grove, West London. It was built on the back of a huge fundraising effort, largely from within what was beginning to look like a more cohesive gay and lesbian community. The Don't Die of Ignorance public health campaign was bolstered in February 1987 by a week of cross-channel AIDS-related programming. The public were becoming more aware of the crisis and seemingly more fearful and hard-line. Not least, perhaps, because of the frightening tone of some public health material and the exponential growth in newspaper reports curating voices which articulated disgust, distrust and anger at the immorality and neediness of gay men and drug users especially. So you can see how the move against homosexual men was being charted by the British Social Attitudes Survey there. And you can really see the uptick in homophobic newspaper reporting in 1987 as opposed to 86. The newly re-elected Prime Minister was meanwhile driving forward a combination of economic liberalism and moral conservatism, and perhaps trying to disguise the former with a nostalgic appeal to the latter. There we go. Let's hear a bit of Margaret Thatcher.
Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values have been taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
I could have cut her out. Clause 28, which promised to prohibit local authorities from promoting homosexuality or gay pretended family relationships, was tabled in 1987. It passed into law as Section 28 of the Local Government Act in the following year. So these were some of the contexts in which Mass Observer A1108 was writing. And in what follows, I want to tug the emotional threads of his testimony through other archival collections that I've been exploring to show the interweaving language of emotion of this particular year. The collections were, I found, saturated with emotion, sometimes articulated, sometimes not, making these archival encounters amongst the most moving I've ever had. Page after page of heartbreaking, disturbing, sometimes infuriating writing, writing which I've found hard to navigate or to know quite how to communicate here. And I've only given the barest sense of this by peppering the slides with quotes from the different archives that I've visited. This made me very thoughtful about the emotional relationship I, historians and researchers more broadly, have with our work. The experience reminded me too that however difficult in the emotions in the past are to deal with and to interpret, however tempting it is to sideline them, they are at the heart of historical experience and a motor of social change. So these emotions aren't a side issue, I want to suggest, but are actually absolutely central to what happened next. Emotions in this way are never only personal. They're woven into attempts to voice, prompt and persuade in a multitude of places, from the domestic to the debating chambers of Westminster. Staying close to and tracking such feelings through the archive, amassing an archive of feeling, is thus important. And so here I chart the emotional landscapes around 1987, taking my cue from Mass Observer A1108, testimony, which we've seen highlights four things, and I'm going to deal with these things in turn. So the first thing is a general anxiety about HIV and AIDS. The second is a specific disdain for gay men and their allies. The third is this fear for children on the part of parents especially. And the fourth is the embattled position gay men often found themselves in. Now in doing this, I want to pursue three interconnected arguments, which I've already begun to sketch out. The first argument is about the power of emotional rhetoric in shaping what is felt, said, and done. The second is about the way in which people were caught in communities of feelings and particular styles of expression, which were hard to move against because they've dominated or appeared as obvious or self-evident. So it's really interesting how the language, the emotive language in the popular press, for example, how frequently it gets repeated in the way people are writing their testimonies or giving their interviews. So it gets that idea of framing AIDS in a particular way, a particular emotive way, carries through people's everyday discourse, everyday language. But it's also clear how with sometimes small gestures and because of cross-cutting affiliations, people often also pushed against such seemingly emotional imperatives. And we see that with Mark's friend in the office. So this was a straight woman who pushed against the domineering rhetoric or the domineering idea of how she should react. The third and final strand of argument is about the significance of archives like these in helping us to tell a more nuanced and complex story, and so intervene in sweeping or oversimplified cultural memories of this period as a time only of acute polarisation, for example. These archives suggest ways in which emotional styles and expectations change over time, yet have threads of continuity which haunt our present, and that's something I'll come back to in the end. So I'm spelling out these arguments here in case I get lost and we lose a sense of them, but that's what I'm getting at. So let's start with fear and anxiety, which our Mass Observer suggested amongst the council office workers, not least. This apparent public mood was, firstly, something that government was very worried about. In the middle months of 1986, the Health Secretary, Norman Fowler, encountered resistance from his cabinet colleagues on his plans for a mass leaflet drop to every household in the country. Some ministers feared the presence of such a leaflet in homes might not only corrupt, but might also fuel already escalating fears about the virus. Ministers in ministerial discussions. So I looked at the cabinet notes of these meetings, and ministers focused on the worry, alarm, offence, fear, and panic that might be prompted in the public when they received this leaflet. There was yet also in this a deflection of their own feelings as they pitched rational government against overly emotional public. So you can see how they're characterising these two realms. There was concern about how to engage with AIDS in a suitably public voice. And in cabinet discussion, we see something of the way anticipated public emotions and the emotional worlds of ministers circumscribed political horizons and what it seemed possible to do, say, and defend. local councils suggesting other ways of reacting were labelled loony. You remember the loony left councils. That is the opposite to what was rational, common sense, and in line with the prevailing emotional context or regime. Ensuing ministerial comment, campaign material, and then to the press and TV response provided an emotive language with which to describe AIDS and those directly affected by it. They also so suggested ways of responding, including angry finger pointing, which I'll come to shortly, and extreme caution in the everyday. If there was an emotional consensus amongst mass observers, it was anxiety and fear, though arraigned across quite a spectrum. Some are mildly worried, some are fearful of even going out the door. Sometimes that exact anxiety was directly articulated. Often it was measured against more fearful others. And sometimes it can be inferred from the changes some mass observers made to their daily lives in terms of taking communion in a different way, taking their own scissors and combs to the hairdressers, avoiding swimming pools, not buying trousers in charity shops, which came up actually 4 times in the mass observer testimony. I've not even thought of buying a pair of trousers as a risky activity. It was apparent too in the geographies of risk some outlined. London especially was a hazardous, almost radioactive zone in some people's testimonies. As we saw with the man who hurled abuse at mass observer A1108 at Heathrow, this general sense of threat gets wrapped around gay men in feelings ranging from unease to repulsion. Although there's no mention of gays or homosexuals in the questions sent out to mass observers, and although the public health broadcast didn't mention them either, almost all mass observers made the connection between those people and AIDS and marked themselves out from such distant, dubious, and sorrowful villains and victims in various ways. Anger, fear, and disgust run through many mass observer testimonies relating to the virus, but more frequently to gay men. Several found AIDS to be an apt outcome as bodily pleasures were punished with bodily decline. So here we have Rod Cudson, who is remembered by many of the mass observers, and who, like a latter-day Dorian Gray, had apparently had his sins written on his body, shocking and terrifying those associated with him. No wonder he felt ashamed, at least according to the Daily Mail. Some mass observers were indeed dismayed that the huge shift in sexual behaviour amongst gay men in the 1980s was not always in the direction of the monogamy almost all mass observers experienced for themselves and wanted to see in others. The angrily entrenched positions dividing mother and son in the second quote here, so I don't know if you can read it, says, "It's what you do, not how many with. I shouted that at my mother when she said she was glad of AIDS because it had reduced promiscuity." So these angry positions that mother and son have here reflect a wider sense of moral fracture between gay men and a moral majority. And in fact, Thatcher used repeatedly the idea of the moral majority with gay men on the outside of that. And just to roll back a little bit, in the 1967 Sexual Offences Act, which partially decriminalised sex between men over 21 in private, Lord Arran, a strong proponent of the Act, famously asked homosexuals to show their gratitude by, and I'm quoting, "comporting themselves quietly and with dignity." Lord Arran was signalling as clearly as the Act itself the limits of permissiveness and the conditions of acceptability. Many gays and lesbians, and especially those involved in the Gay Liberation Front, moved against such conditions vocally and visibly in the 1970s. In the Thatcherite 1980s, however, and in the context of the AIDS crisis, the stakes were much higher. Of necessity because of the health crisis, and as a result of a related and growing pride and protest movement and the equalities agendas of some local councils, gay men and lesbians were now trespassing further on public attention, public space, and in health and social care needs, on the public purse. So it's much more difficult now to think about gay men being over there because they were in hospital, visibly in hospital surgeries and hospitals and needing care and being talked about. So they were, in a sense, trespassing more on this supposedly heterosexual space. There was thus anger with gay men, not only because of the alarming threat they posed because of AIDS, but because of the ways in which they were, for often related reasons, failing to comport themselves either quietly or with dignity, and were becoming more visible and demanding in this year. So this is a quote from the Times, the columnist Bernard Levin. Levin condemned what he called the galloping frenzy of hate against homosexuals in 1987, but he went on to say that a minority of homosexuals abused the new freedom of the 1967 Sexual Offences Act, offered often by flaunting themselves in an extravagant outre mode of behaviour, well calculated to disgust heterosexuals, including many who were sympathetic. They've caused resentment because of the aggressive tone they adopted, campaigning for their rights, abetted by hard left local councils. Notice here the dance of hate, disgust, resentment, and lost sympathy, and also a pressing sense of the direct as well as creeping danger these men posed. The piece appears under a headline linking gays with the Gestapo, just, it should be noted, as Klaus Barbie was being prosecuted in France for the wartime atrocities he had committed. Another journalist, Graham Hancock, had made a similar plea for toleration of homosexuals a year earlier, but warned similarly that die-hard gays were using their erect penises as weapons of war. So this is the kind of paranoia that we're getting in the mainstream press. The treachery, danger, and selfishness of gay men and their allies rang through a number of mass observer testimonies. The Thatcher government itself was meanwhile attempting some containment by re-articulating the idea of bestowed and limited tolerance whilst trouncing the idea of rights and equalities. So this bumper sticker was spotted by a number of mass observers in Wales with the invitation to run over a queer in order to help resolve the AIDS crisis. I want to move on to empathy, which is slightly more reassuring, because it's very easy to draw out the most negatively impassioned and shocking testimonies and reports. They're the ones that hit you between the eyes. Such testimonies can suggest an emotional pitch which was not sustained across all the testimonies in this archive, across all media, or amongst all members of Parliament. These feelings were yet circulating in print and in everyday conversations, and signalled something of what it felt possible and permissible to say and do. They had currency in themselves, but they were important too because they prompted others, gay and straight, to push back, and often as emotively. So this is the kind of more empathetic response. So there's a series of examples there, but there was plenty of them. Divisions between gay and straight, and rational conservatives and those loonies on the left, were dramatised in the press and were articulated directly in some testimonies. Overall, the mass observation sample and the British and the BSA, what's that? Overall, the mass observation sample signalled that women tended to be more empathetic than men, and that those who were growing up in the 1960s tended to be more tolerant than their elders. Maybe no surprises there. Yet, as Simon Watney wrote at the time, lives were rarely lived in such oppositions. Relationships with friends, family and work colleagues frequently cut across those various divides as people muddled through in their everyday lives. The emotional top notes resonated widely nevertheless and created a self-consciousness, even though for those who rejected the prevalent discourse, the prevailing divisive presumptions. And we see something of this in this 47-year-old woman's description of her gay neighbours. She said, "They look very respectable. It's quite a humdrum marriage and they're nicely spoken and decent to me. Usually they cause smiles, a bit covert, or hilarity from the kids. So far as I know, they've not been harassed, but occasionally you see visitors to the house, workmen, gardeners, etc., bare their teeth and make derisive noises." It seems like the working classes can't actually speak in this woman's account. "Other visitors come to the house at weekends, arriving very quietly after dark and leaving quietly very late. They're mostly male. However, I don't inquire what they're about. They could be the local debating society, for all I know. Clearly, there's a need to be discreet and not cause a rumpus. It's kind of my favourite extract from the whole archive. Whilst the platform speaker at the 1986 Conservative Party conference had proclaimed to mass applause that if you wanted a queer for a neighbour, you should vote Labour, this woman takes a different and more sympathetic tack. She observes in the men next door a certain admirable restraint. They are decent, respectable, and discreet, performing, perhaps rather self-consciously, those conditions for middle-class tolerance. The restraint was a part of emotional connection between the neighbours. Traces of the wider emotional pulse I've talked about were yet palpable in her testimony. First, in the less restrained reactions she patronisingly observes in the children and the angry, inarticulate workers who she tacitly measures herself against in terms of her tolerance. And second, in the way she betrays her own fascination with these homosexual neighbours, who she manages both to align herself with by being middle class and respectable, and distance herself from. What I think is hilarious is that she obviously watches them really closely, like she's constantly looking at these comings and goings and who's coming into the house and what they're doing and so on. Clearly fascinated. Other mass observers struggled with or were aware of their own unease, reflecting directly on the tension between what they knew in terms of risk and transmission and what they felt. So this is quite a palpable or powerful part of these testimonies. These were some of the daily negotiations that structured people's experience of the crisis and the emotions that clung to it. And perhaps these become clearest in relation to children. We've seen already how these how often children are writ large. The office worker that mass observer A1108 mentioned justified his own behaviour through his need to protect his children. Clause 28 sought to protect children from too much of or the wrong sort of knowledge. Now, children were actual people to worry about, of course, and for parents especially. And we see this in various ways and to various degrees in these testimonies. Children were also, though, more broadly symbols of an uncertain future. And as we've seen, their vulnerability, the vulnerability of that future, wove through government and press rhetoric. Children were often used to specify and enlarge the threat posed by gay men, suggesting in the process the need for parents to protect their children from gay men. And this is the rhetoric that really rose to the fore in these years. The parents of gay children were thus in a very challenging position. We learn through multiple testimonies from gay men that many parents cut off their shameful offspring. But in correspondence in the Family and Friends of Lesbian and Gays archive, we find parents struggling to support their sons as others decried and derided them. And I think in a way this was the most moving archive I visited. Their child coming out in this context, in the context of the 80s, was grievous. And I mean that quite specifically because from the testimonies in this archive, it becomes clear that grief in the 1980s had become a model for understanding and also communicating feelings about having a gay child. These parents were grieving the straight child they had lost, and perhaps the grandchildren now apparently they were no longer going to have. They grieved their gay son's social death, and the actual death that AIDS seemed to hold in store for him. This, the third writer suggests, was not inevitable or natural, but arose from the social positioning of gay men. So many parents suffer grief and feelings of bereavement because of the kind of views espoused by your correspondent. So FFLAG, the people involved in FFLAG were also campaigning so they would letter write in response to particularly homophobic articles. Several FFLAG parents, once through the grieving process, signalled their support by aligning themselves with what they saw as the emotional worlds of their sons, cultivating pride as the flip side of the shame attached to their sons' sexuality and their own failure as parents. So many of these parents talk about how they failed their children. What was it they'd done that had made them this way? Their letters are filled with self-accusation, And some ameliorated this through that pride, which we started out with, and which was, in different ways, a touchstone emotion for parents who expressed it for their children, and for lesbians and gays who expressed it politically in relation to their identity and community. So you can see parents are talking about pride for their children, their sons are talking about pride in their sexual identity. There's a different texture to it in some ways. Meanwhile, using the language and status of motherhood, as this woman does in her draft letter to the press, allowed her to connect and appeal to a potential community of supposedly shared feeling. Speaking as a mother from that position had more emotional purchase than speaking as a gay man. So you can see how she's using motherhood as a way of communicating a political point. For other parents, that move towards pride just felt impossible. Some learnt that their sons were gay and that they were dead or dying at the same time, and they entered a closeted world. There was perhaps some sense of shame at what the disease revealed about their son and his intimate life. There were also perhaps a pressing desire to protect his legacy and perhaps themselves from the judgment of others. Simon Watney goes on to describe the stark difference between the sense of silenced shame which clung around his friend Bruno at his suburban funeral and the positive feelings that surrounded this life-affirming man he knew in central London. Like variations in risk, emotions also get mapped out in these testimonies. Feelings of shame, pleasure, pride and fear became associated with particular places and in particular to network and to particular networks and groups of people. So you repeatedly get this idea of the conservative repressed suburbs and the more out there central city areas, which isn't necessarily reflected in people's experience. We've seen this already, but I want to track it a little bit further as I pull through the very final thread from that opening testimony, the one that relates to Mass Observer A1108 himself as a gay man. Now, what most Mass Observers tend not to imagine is the sense of emotional overload and roller coaster for gay men at this time. In testimonies submitted to the National Lesbian and Gay Survey, which gathered testimonies at the same time, fear and anxiety have a different, more immediate, more visceral cadence than they do when described by Mass Observers. Shame, loneliness and despair were recurrent, even in those fabled centres of gay community like London and Brighton. These emotions have a long queer history, but they were reinflected and given fresh currency in the context of the epidemic and the exposure it sometimes entailed. I've suggested already that the headline prejudice did not translate straightforwardly into the way people thought, felt and behaved towards gay men. National Lesbian and Gay Survey respondents and a detailed study in 1988 yet suggest that many gay men felt embattled and believed in the blanket condemnation of others. The apparent anger, disgust and fear of the supposed moral majority was part of what configured the emotional, practical and political responses to and of gay men. So there's something quite interesting, I think, in the way gay men interviewed at this time assumed that everybody else was against them. That was the kind of rhetoric, the emotional rhetoric that was circulating, even though in their daily lives they may not have quite experienced that. Others have argued powerfully that such perceived and actual emotional judgments have fundamentally shaped gay identity and community. Men may take on shame and inferiority others heaped upon them. They might also deliberately thwart expectation by finding ways in the margins, in some of those pretended families perhaps, of feeling differently, of feeling pleasure, pride and anger, for example. The singer Jimmy Somerville suggests something of this emotional dance in his 1987 song for his friend Mark Ashton, with whom I began. The song opens, "I never cried the way I cried over you, as I put down the telephone and the world it carried on. Somewhere else, someone else is crying too. Another man has lost a friend. I bet he feels the way I do." Somerville relates his grief in this first verse and also touches a sense of emotional community with other gay men grieving. He moves us further on in the second verse, which I'm going to play to you rather than... Or maybe I'm not going to play it to you. Let's have a look. I want to play it with you partly so you have a break from my voice. Here we go. Sure what happened with the video there, but you got the idea. In Somerville's tribute to Mark Ashton, friendship, love, grief, anger, and here contempt are folded together in, quote, a battle found. We see here quite clearly the connection of mourning and militancy. There was a felt need for many to connect and find solidarities, as Mark, and indeed Somerville, then part of Bronski Beat, had done with the miners and their families. The red flag in the video is not incidental, so there's an idea of a politics absolutely drawn through these expressions of grief. It could feel imperative in this context for gay men to frame and experience emotions in particular ways. And yet the anger and pride many felt and displayed publicly was sometimes, as I've suggested, part of a more complex emotional juggling act, which included various related but more negative and less openly acknowledged feelings. One National Lesbian and Gay Survey correspondent felt more vulnerable as a gay man in the light of the new activism than he had in the 1950s and 1960s, a reminder that age and generation might qualify the feelings it felt possible to have and to express at particular moments. The emotional context of this man's earlier life in the 50s and 60s was folded into his present in ways that made it difficult for him to feel connected to the new emotional tenor and community he was encountering amongst gay men in the 1980s. It was, he said, out of step with his sense of himself and his sense of homosexuality to be so proud and angry. He couldn't relate to those emotions. Okay, so what I've tried to do in this talk is to give a sense of the emotional dance between differently invested and engaged people in one particular year. I've suggested the ways in which music, the press, TV, ministerial and prime ministerial pronouncements, and daily interactions between family, friends, and workmates honed emotional styles and set off particular emotional dynamics in relation to AIDS, HIV, and by close association, gay men. These styles and dynamics prompted and also legitimised certain government acts and actions, Section 28 not least. Individuals could feel justified in the everyday exclusions or even abuse they were party to, partly because of this prevailing emotional climate. Others were prompted to fierce opposition and protest because of the raw anger and hate they were faced with or witnessed. Alongside, and again perhaps in partial reaction, health professionals and community organisations saw the particular importance of developing approaches and policies which could provide sustained and compassionate support and care for those living with HIV and AIDS, those who were ill and dying. The emotive language that circled the crisis in 1987 is, of course, identifiable before. We see it developing across the preceding years. It's also familiar from earlier renditions of the homosexual, venereal disease and the outsider in much earlier years. It is, in its, I think, wider articulation in 1986 and 87, this language perhaps caused particular fear and pain, however. and also set certain tones and underpinned certain reactions in the years that followed and as deaths and diagnoses escalated, from the total of 610 at the end of 1987 to a total of 12,105 by 1996, the year antiretroviral drugs began to transform treatment and prognosis. Bulging files on the AIDS crisis in the LAGNA, which is the Lesbian and Gay News Media Archive, show that sections of the press continued to peddle fear and loathing after 1987. There was a rise in reports of murder, attacks, and abuse of gay men, alongside pride and protest. And a mass lesbian and gay movement really got underway, perhaps ameliorating for some the sense of containment and isolation. Following the wartime emergency years of 86 and 87, we can identify a professionalisation and normalisation in medical and government response to the epidemic as hospitals and deaths became more and more frequent and tragically routine. The pool of those grieving, meanwhile, grew. The emotional heat did abate over this period, and public opinion began to shift. So this again is the British Social Attitudes Survey, especially after the treatment breakthroughs of 1996. This was the year Ducky, my favourite club in London, began having some camp fun with the interface of pride and shame in its annual festival of homosexual misery that took place on Pride Night. So they would, you would have drag queens there counselling you in how terrible it was to be a homosexual. Very, very, very witty. When Mass Observation asked its panel about gays in the family in 2001, we find that most were markedly more relaxed than they had been in 1987. The emotional styles woven around and directing such opinion had shifted by this time. Legal changes in adoption, civil partnership and marriage folded gays and lesbians, for better or worse, into more legitimised emotional communities and rituals. There was yet a continuing whiff of the sentiments I've discussed in relation to 1987. Here, probably, but certainly in South Africa, where I'm been doing further research into the crisis, the shame and fear of a HIV diagnosis is still preventing people from testing and seeking treatment, even where it's available, and is thus a vector for the spread of the virus. In other words, the emotions felt in response to the virus are preventing people getting the healthcare they need. Indeed, now treatment can be so effective, it is such emotions that can cause the most harm and the most pain. These feelings are sticky and hard to dispel, even in rather changed contexts. This is because those feelings relate to some long and tortured history. Almost 30 years after the release of For a Friend, Jimmy Somerville described in an interview with The Independent how his life was still marked by this period, by the poisonous emotional climate, and by Mark's death. Though Somerville's song appears in the film Pride, he said that he couldn't bear to watch it in the cinema because he would just bawl his eyes out. The emotionally laden archives I work through speak to that past, and that past that still exists in our present. As I've suggested, they form commentaries on the emotional terrain laid out stridently in the press and by politicians, and they provide evidence of how individuals negotiated that terrain and in ways inflected by earlier experiences. The emotion I felt within these collections was certainly to do with the material I was looking at. It was to do with my own memories of, and also some nostalgia for this period. But it was, I think, also about the context in which I was doing this research and what I was reading in the papers as I travelled to and from the archive. This was the period over the Brexit debate and Trump's election. The gender theorist Judith Butler very recently wrote that that year had seen the emancipation of unbridled hate against those who apparently threaten our values, our economy, our bodies and ourselves. Reported hate crime in the UK has increased markedly over the past few years, with this horrendous example just last week. And that has included a particular spike in homophobic abuse and assault. The philosopher Walter Benjamin in 1940, in the midst of war, wrote that to articulate the past historically means to seize hold of a memory as it flashes up at moments of danger. Rather poetic turn of phrase, which I like. To return to one moment of danger, in this case 1987 and the AIDS crisis, to try to grasp its emotional complexity might, I suggest, allow us to see more clearly the dangers which threaten us now, and suggest too something of our need for vigilance and our capacity to resist and respond effectively.